Hi, welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we are going to the ballet with Natalie Portman in what has been arguably one of the best received films of the season. Joining me is an old regular, well, now an old regular. Matt, how are you?
Excellent. Thank you very much, Mike. Good to be here.
Matt, where are you at the moment?
I am at my home in Keswick, Virginia, on the east coast of the United States.
Now, are you under 18 feet of snow?
No, we lucked out. We dodged the storm of the century, I guess they were calling it. It just passed just north of here. We might get a little snow this weekend, but nothing of any severity. Not like what Jason's been getting up in New York.
Yeah, no, it's pretty incredible. And of course, we've had really bad weather here in Queensland. We had flooding, and now we've had a Category 5 cyclone that's just gone through. But we're not here to discuss the weather, unfortunately, though we do sympathize with those people that have been through kind of hell on earth. But also joining us is a new member of the VFX show, Ty Rubin. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Now, I'm going to have to grill you a little bit, sorry, just so that everyone knows your background, because we're really enthusiastic to have you on the show, and just it's great that you can join us. But for those of you that obviously are keen to know your background, you've obviously got a very strong film background. Maybe you could just give us a bit of a rundown on the sort of work that you do.
Yeah, well, I was a huge fan of movies as a kid, as most everyone is. But you know, probably the most important film moment, which you find as being the moment of clarity for so many people my age in the film business, which was 2001: Space Odyssey. And I think that that film and its kind of ambiguous message provoked my imagination in a way that I started to actually think in terms of film as something that was a possibility to attach myself to down the road. And so even though I was growing up in the Midwest, I grew up in a small town in northern Minnesota, I was able to start to think about, wouldn't it be cool to make movies and how do they get made? And I got really curious about the process. So there wasn't even a film program when I went to college. I took a fine arts degree, and eventually through networking, which is everyone's story that works in Hollywood, I arrived at George Lucas's visual effects company, Industrial Light and Magic, in 1989. So I arrived there at a time when they were still doing most of the work practically. Most of the work was being done with models and miniature, motion control photography, and doing optical compositing and blue screen extraction. And in the time frame that I was there, which was from, you know, like I mentioned, 89 to 1995 when I left, I kind of saw the cusp of the movement from traditional film-based visual effects, you know, practical visual effects, to digital. And while I was at ILM, I was fortunate enough to find my way into working with Dennis Muren, and that led to my being the effects art director on Jurassic Park. And then I kind of became one of the senior art directors who had the chops to work in the digital, you know, the digital field, as it were, the digital filmmaking part of the company. Really was hard to get experience in those films because there was really only a couple of movies a year being made there. And then that led to me working on, you know, the Flintstones and Disclosure and Casper. And eventually, just as I was leaving, I was the visual effects art director on the first re-release that George was working on, which was A New Hope, the first, you know, the first Star Wars picture. So I actually was able to sit on my parents' couch and read Starlog about Star Wars, and then ended up with the credit on the movie. Not only just working with the director, but working on the exact film that kind of, you know, was another one of my big touchstones alongside of 2001, like I mentioned. And then I just, once I left Industrial Light and Magic, I started working as a designer, conceptual designer, and worked with Guillermo del Toro on his first American picture, Mimic. Was the creature designer for that, and he introduced me to other directors. And I had met Jim Cameron while he was working on Terminator 2, and I had kind of built a little bit of a relationship with him. So, eventually I was did some work for him in 2002, and eventually became one of the first hires on Avatar, where I was the vehicle designer for the film. And And subsequently, since Avatar, I've got a couple other pictures that I've worked on. Battle Los Angeles, which comes out in a few months, and Priest, which comes out, I think, in May also. And I've got some other things kind of brewing, but that's what's on the roster for the short term.
Yes, and I should confess that you were the conceptual designer on Surrogates, and while I didn't like the film and this show, I said so. I really thought the design was excellent.
Well, I'm either very excited to tell you or quite sad to say that I haven't actually seen the picture.
Right, okay. Well, yes. Though never has a picture more appealed to me on a poster and let me down in a cinema than that one. But anyway.
I actually was doing primarily the mechanical interface between the human operators and that kind of the surrogate devices,
right.
The surrogate robots. So I was kind of doing more mechanical design, and for all kinds of reasons, I'm not so sure how much of it actually translated to what was on screen. But
you did character design on Signs, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I did some of some alien concept work for that. They had kind of gone down a certain path, the ILM team had, and I kept I kind of would bounce back into that universe of Industrial Light and Magic from time to time. I actually kept very productive relationship with the company. So when they needed some assistance, they would call me in when I was available, when I was up in Marin County, where I actually have always lived up there. You're going to ask me where I am now. I'm actually in Arizona at this moment. But I was asked to come and look at the sign stuff kind of as a fresh eye, you know, because they had a group working on it and it wasn't quite gelling. And so I was put in a room and given, you know, the footage and shown it kind of in the, you know, without any information about the story or what had been before, you know, come before it, and just kind of made some kind of, some observations that came to my mind that were more about my own personal take on the material just from seeing the references and stuff. And it did have an impact, and so I was pleased about that.
Well, I don't know how relevant character design work is, but certainly your art direction background is much needed for our discussion today as we swing around to discussing Black Swan. Now, this is a film that I should tell you guys listening that I didn't have on our roster to cover. We had done a story on it on FX Guide, but I just didn't have it on my roster, partly because I didn't cover the story on FX Guide, and so I hadn't seen the film when it was delayed in its release here in Australia. And suddenly, the other members of the VFX show team started pestering me with emails like, "Are you out of your friggin' mind? We've got to do a show on this," including you guys. So, Matt, I'm going to throw it over to you first. You were quite vocal in saying that you thought we should do a VFX show about this. But more than that, I think you applauded it as just a good example of great filmmaking. Do you want to give us your rundown?
Yeah, I mean, I went and saw the movie with my wife, and she was really keen to see it, and I was excited to go see the new Darren Aronofsky flick, and, you know, thought it'd be fun to watch Natalie Portman for 90 minutes or so. And we went to the theater, and I wasn't totally sure what to expect. I didn't read a whole lot about the film before seeing it, but I would say it's interesting. My experience in the theater, and my wife had the same experience. It totally blew our minds. You know, we walked out of there and we were both totally amped because it was just this really high anxiety, really intense, kind of relentless narrative. And my wife is a painter, and I've always worked in film, and so I think, you know, sort of the metaphors in the story, sort of the nature of the creative process and giving yourself over to the process and stuff was something we both really kind of got jazzed on, and it had a real kind of surrealist and experimental quality to it as well that is something that I feel like I don't see films like this very often. It really resonated in a lot of ways for me. It reminded me a lot of – I did a lot of work with the American artist Matthew Barney for a lot of his Cream Master Cycle projects, and a film he did with Bjork a few years back in Japan. Mm-hmm. And his process is very much one that's all about the physical and putting his physical performance and his own person into his work, and dealing with sort of biological metaphors. And I felt like this was kind of right up that alley. So it spoke to a lot of my interests, and I just totally enjoyed it. One thing I did find that was really interesting, though, in my excitement for the film, I was sort of like telling all my friends, you got to go see this. And some friends of mine back in San Francisco, some really good friends of mine who I grew up with and friends that I went to college with and stuff, who I totally respect, who are incredibly, I consider them to be very sophisticated, intelligent characters. And they were just like, are you crazy? I hated that movie. And I have found that to be the case where almost everybody that I've spoken to, I would say it's really split down the middle. Like half the people I talk to are like, oh my God, you're right. It's great. I've totally loved it. It was an amazing film. I haven't, I just was riveted. And some people really just felt like it was super melodramatic. It really split down the middle in terms of the reactions that I saw from, at least from people that I know.
Ty, before you saw it, what were you expecting to see? Were you expecting to see this kind of a film? I mean, how well did you know what you were going to see?
No, I mean, it was a strange thing because I actually saw it as a screener. I'd gotten it an advanced copy of it on DVD, so I'm actually very disappointed I didn't get to see it in the theater, and I wasn't really that up to speed on it. So when I got it, I thought, oh great, I heard about this Aronofsky film, and that'll be fun to see. And I kind of set it on the bookshelf with some other discs, and I'd really liked The Wrestler, but I felt like The Wrestler was a film that, it was sort of a film that was made for, in my mind, a certain kind of film goer. It was sort of a film that wasn't as much about entertainment as, like the kind of vaudevillian entertainment that a lot of films kind of create, but much more of a kind of retro film that was about, a human story that was kind of its own enigma in a way. It was like, what's motivating this guy and why can't he keep his life together? So I kind of went to the Black Swan with a similar idea that it was going to be something along those lines. It was probably going to be a character study, and it was probably going to have its own kind of human story that's about how frailties and dysfunctionality come into, kind of become the demons of a person's life. And to a degree, I was right. But what I hadn't expected and what I was really pleased with was the kind of visual tenacity and kind of relentless, really iconic image making. I mean, moments that, whether you had seen it in the narrative context or not, you just had to kind of blink your eyes at the kind of brilliance of the image making. And it reminded me in a number of ways of the feelings that I had in the 70s when I was seeing films that I think were made for a more adult audience. Back in the 70s, the average film goer was more, they weren't really catering to the 10 to 17 year old market. Most R-rated films were 18 to 35, and sure. I think that there was a feeling that this was a movie for people that had some life experience. This was a movie that was meant to let you ponder about life's conditions, which is the feeling I got from like Robert Altman's Three Women or from Midnight Cowboy, those kind of classic 70s movies, which were about kind of the strange enigma which is life. And that kind of angle coupled with the kind of stylistic just really, really savvy image creation, image making, and the moments it just kind of captivated me. And it almost feels as though I did go to the cinema to see it because it so overpowered my psyche from the television screen.
Yeah, interestingly, there's a theory that it was actually envisaged to be part of the sort of mirror plot of The Wrestler, mm-hmm. a love affair between a ballet dancer and a wrestler, and this, of course, didn't happen. It became two films, quite separate. I can't see that myself. I don't think there's any remnants of that in it, because it seems so complete in of itself and so encapsulated in its own arc of mirroring the plot. I think there's a number of things I want to discuss this week. I'd like to discuss, obviously, the visual effects, as we will. As our sort of parallel topic, I would like to discuss this retro aspect, because from a filmmaking point of view, there were a lot of decisions that were made that I think underlie the points that you will make, not least of which was the fact that it was shot on 16mm, which is very, I was going to say very unusual, but then, of course, Hurt Locker was 16mm as well. But certainly in an age where we're increasingly becoming digital and very few films are not asking the question whether they shouldn't be shooting digitally instead of 35, to go 16 is, especially on low budget, is remarkable. This is a film with a budget of $13 million, so we need to frame everything, I think, in terms of that. It's not as big a budget as maybe Natalie Portman's attached, or even some of the other actresses' names attached would have you believe. In fact, I believe it's so tight on money that when Natalie Portman was actually hurt during filming, they didn't have a medic, and she offered to give up her trailer, which they took her up on the offer for, so they could get a medic on set. It really was like super low budget, and I don't think we can tackle either of those two subjects, the subject of the retro filmmaking or the visual effects, without first starting with Natalie Portman's performance, because at every level that you want to analyze this film at, it's going to come back to Natalie Portman. It's her dedication to the craft. I mean, she lost 20 pounds to do the role, but she, you know, you can't discuss the visual effects unless you realize that they didn't body double her for just about a bunch of shits. Like, it was her dancing, and she did an incredible job. And of course, the other thing is, she just acts so well in this. Matt, had you worked with Natalie before? Have you done stuff with her? Was she?
No, I haven't. I mean, I worked a little bit on episode what was it? Episode one, I guess. But around the time I was getting ready to leave ILM and go to work on another project in another part of the country, but I remember seeing her in the dailies, but I never had an opportunity to work directly with her.
I worked with her in Sydney on some commercials, and I mean, she wouldn't know me from Adam, but I was on set, obviously filming with her, and I was struck then by her kind of earnestness. And this was at a time around, I think she was in Australia for Star Wars. And this is stuff for Japan. So she was, she came across as a professional, somebody that was the antithesis of ditzy. She didn't, I think, fulfilled her sort of creative potential in the Star Wars films, because they weren't those sorts of films. But I'd be kind of stunned if she didn't get the Oscar for this, because I've not seen an actress commit to a role like she committed to this. Ty, would you agree with me? And she just is an absolutely incredible performance.
Yeah, I mean, she, you know, she embodied the a dual character, which, you know, a lot of actors and actresses love that kind of, you know, a character that they can really, you know, take from one extreme to another in the context of a film. But what I found surprising was how it was kind of blurred. Like, it was supposed to be the white swan who becomes the dark swan, but the white swan was just as kind of screwed up in many, many ways, lacked kind of a clarity of what her normal everyday life was about. I mean, she was already this kind of brooding dark thing. And then by becoming this, you know, the black swan, which was really supposed to be the embodiment of, like, the seductress and, you know, the darker side of things, she actually kind of found purity because she was, you know, complete in a weird form. And so I think that not only did she excel at playing a talented dancer, but she was dealing with those emotions that are very complicated for humans to manage in a general sense, which is like internal conflict, which is showing itself through these kind of outbursts and these inflections and the way that she looked at herself in the mirror and, you know, kind of looking as though below the surface of her own persona was a lot more material that you really couldn't, you know, you couldn't just put your finger on. So it was like a tapestry of things going on with her. And I just was lost in the character after, you know, after the first few minutes. I actually wasn't really quite sure it was her sometimes. That's why it was so strange when you saw extra versions of her. I thought, well, geez, she keeps not looking like Natalie Portman, so maybe I'm seeing everybody else in the movie is suddenly Natalie Portman. So I think that he played that kind of duality really well, because I think there's a moment where she passes herself, on a street in New York.
On the way to the subway,
And then you're like, well, that was her. But then you go, well, maybe it really wasn't her, because it looked like a lot of the footage of her was very hard to get an exact bead on what she looked like. It's really
Way in which they integrate all that stuff into the visual motif in the film. You know, she's in every shot essentially, right? And you're really traveling with her on that journey, kind of through her own sort of psyche, and you're never totally sure whether or not what you're seeing or what is being portrayed on the screen is, you know, is this something that's just in her head, or is this something that's really going on? And he kind of continues to play with that throughout the film in a way that's really interesting.
I think one of the things I find most rewarding about this film is that I would have hated this film had it stopped three quarters of the way through and you had no resolution, or even 90% of the way through, you had no resolution of any sense that what was reality or wasn't. Like, sometimes filmmakers have this kind of, you know, it's very ambiguous what's real or not, and we're going to leave it to the audience and we're going to keep them guessing. And I find that's a very unfulfilling way to make a film. It cheats me as an audience member. In this, it was very confusing at times because the director wanted it confusing, but not in a way that was unmotivated by an overall arc that was going to not come together. So it's not like every question is answered, but certainly there was a sense that you could come away from the film making sense of what had happened, not left, well, that was really dumb. Why didn't she just do X in Act 3? And, huh? You know, like, who was that guy? And there was none of that. It was not like there were loose ends. Mm. It was a resolved ambiguity, which I think that really is a sophisticated film, because you can lose an audience with stuff that is actually visually on. I mean, for example, passing herself on the street. What did I just see then? Why am I seeing that? And I've got to say, the other thing about this, another film I often reference is Once We Were Warriors, where there is an absolute tension of violence without a lot of on-screen death. And similarly in this, there were sections where I was looking, I like did not watch the screen for some of the fingernail type stuff. I mean, I just was literally not. I stuck my face around and, you know, carefully admired the back of my wife's shoulder because I just couldn't watch. And yet I'll happily sit through a kind of Jaws and Aliens Predator kind of thing. So I think, again, you know, sorry.
Yeah, on that note, this is actually one of the on your earlier note about these kinds of tricks playing on screen, you know, the doubles and the mirror, you know, acting on its own and so forth. I think what he did, Aronofsky did, was he created kind of ambiguous symbolism and kind of enigmatic kinds of moments, but in the larger backdrop of the picture, like you're suggesting, there's a certain structure to it that, even though you can't point to the shot, you know, where she pulls the feather out of her back and say, oh, that is that what that really shows you is this is the, you know, the symbolic moment where she's accepted her role as the Black Swan or whatever, because it's not that specific. It's more generalized and it's more ambiguous in a way that kind of adds seasoning to the larger picture, sort of like a flavor of a larger meal. And I think that the larger meal is what holds it together, and these tapestries of you know, strange moments just kind of invite the viewer to ponder it more carefully and to think on it on a slightly more kind of abstract level of their brain, which is where I think, again, getting back to the 70s, a lot of the films of the 70s were kind of invitations to bring the audience to a place where they were unsure and they were not going to be given the simple answers. And in the best cases, they still were given a structure that allowed them to kind of complete the thoughts or hold it together. But the individual moments just kind of, you know, were there to pop a spark.
Okay, but that's where I draw my line in the sand. That line in the sand between the former, where it was ambiguous and just left all, like, ambiguous, and I walked out feeling completely unfulfilled. And this one, where I had resolution, I had a framework, I could now think and ponder, and did for days, the images and sort of place them in my own head. In fact, it built for me an infrastructure, if you like, a superstructure that I could then reinterpret the film back into. And that's a marvelous film. But now I hated those earlier 70s films that were all like ambiguity, and especially when they were in like ambiguous sexual stuff. And it was just like, oh, for the love of God, you self-indulgent bastard, shut up. This wasn't the case with this film, right? I mean, I'm the first
to say. Well, I think this is a really populist movie, right? I mean, it kind of is playing into a lot of those themes that you're talking about in terms of, or sort of subgenres in the sort of 70s kind of era. It does feel like one of those films, but at the same time, it's also kind of a horror film, and I think it's also kind of a bit of an experimental film, but it's a really compelling and sort of thrilling ride that you're taken on. And I think in the end, it's something that I think winds up being much more accessible in that way too, because you do wind up with a really nice overall structure in the narrative, where you do have a whole arc that you're following that even sort of mirrors the arc and the narrative, you know, of the ballet, and, you know, we sort of know what to expect, and it all culminates with that moment that we've sort of been, you know, hoping to see, which is this, you know, great final performance. And I think it just winds up really succeeding in that way, where you do get a really satisfactory conclusion. All those threads that are sort of woven through the narrative at the beginning come to a really nicely tied together package at the end that leave you with a lot of, you know, not everything is wrapped up totally tightly, but it leaves you with, you know, sort of a sense of satisfaction that maybe you wouldn't get from some of those other films.
I think it's interesting, though, now if we talk just from a, we have to stop being film critics and be visual effects. I think it's interesting to go on that journey with the director. Now, we often hear people talking about this from an actor's point of view, being brave and taking the director and taking a blind leap of faith. I must admit, I thought that there must be visual effects artists that did exactly the same thing. They must have been said, look, what we want to have happen is her skin looks like it's doing this. And somebody would have gone, okay, that's weird, but I'm just going to commit to this because that's what the director wants. Because in isolation, if I'd been given one of those shots, I'd have said, without seeing the movie, of course, because it hadn't been made, I'd have gone, this is going to be crap. I have no idea what's going on. I don't get this. I would have had a hard time being literal about it, and I doubt that the artist would have been a chance to sit down with the director and have, you know, extensive discussions of the script.
The screenwriters, too, for this, I always mention this podcast because it's another really great one, but the Creative Screenwriting Podcast, they did an interview with the two screenwriters for this film, and they had said that Aronofsky had at one point talked to them about, you know, well, maybe at one point in the film, maybe she actually turns into a swan, right? And the screenwriter, when Aronofsky said this, you know, kind of felt really crestfallen, I guess, and he was sort of really worried that, like, oh, this is going to be so cheesy and this is going to be so corny to try to do something like that. And I think it's sort of interesting that that's sort of the initial thought and reaction, because then in some of the materials that Todd put together, I was reading through some of that stuff today, and there was some really interesting stuff where they were talking about some of the transformation effects, like at the very end when she does her transformation, they talked about how they'd experimented with some different things. And one of the things that they'd experimented with was a sort of an extension of Natalie Portman's neck, as well as the sort of the thing that they did wind up doing, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But when they did it, they found that it was really just too goofy looking. And so they sort of dialed it back. So I think there was some of that kind of play.
But you have to commit as an artist to a director's vision, and it would have been hard on a small film like this not to think, I don't know, this is going to be any good because it's so weird and doesn't seem to make any kind of logical sense, and it's not obvious what's going on, and yet, you know, this is now an Oscar-nominated film and is, you know, revered. Let's discuss the other – before we just get to the visual effects, and that's obviously – what we will do and go through the shots. I do want to discuss this filmmaking options from a technical point of view. We've discussed a lot about this retro feel. I'd like your opinion on the fact that this was shot 16mm, and not just that it's 16mm, because that obviously plays into things like graininess and stuff and technically how the comps looked, but also it was very handheld. It had a 70s cinematography style, especially I think in the opening scene where it just smacked to me of that New York independent we've got a 16 mil and we're going to put it on my shoulder and just, you know, break the rules. Ty, what do you think?
Well, I think that you're right. I mean, it tapped into that kind of cinema verite kind of vibe that was popular. And I think oftentimes, too, especially in shooting cities in the 70s, you know, they would wait for the right time of day. They would throw up some cards and they would try to shoot with a lot of existing light and stuff, you know, to try to move quickly and save money. And also they just didn't, you know, invest a kind of manpower to close off streets. And so you had a lot of footage that seemed found, or, you know, you've got a cafe and you just go, hey, there's a great reflection, let's shoot that, you know, walk by here. My sense with this was that it was just so beautifully lit and composed, and the saturations, and I think you could, you know, it definitely captured some of that 16 millimeter feeling, the right amount, because there was a certain amount of the graininess, and the cameras, you know, had a certain kind of, I don't know, I think the size of the camera body allows for certain kinds of movements that kind of telegraph that it's a smaller camera, although you could do that with video now, but I mean, that's sort of the pedigree that it has. But at the same time, I think that it was clearly manipulated. The saturations were perfect, and it really had a kind of illustrious quality that I suspected that they were doing a digital inner negative and adjusting it. So it was a nice hybrid. I mean, I think it was. I just enjoyed watching the whole picture.
So Matt,
I think too, though, that I was going to say that too, that handheld sort of cinema verite thing, I think, was really significant as well and important in sort of the overall sort of emotional journey that sort of we go on as a member of the audience with her, and that being handheld gave the opportunity to create kind of a stylistic feeling where we could actually feel like we were on the stage, we were in the performance, we were moving through other dancers. We were sort of involved in the movements that were taking place on stage. And I think that helped sort of heighten kind of a level of involvement as well as a level of tension, you know, that maybe wouldn't have been as present if it had been shot in a more traditional fashion.
But Matt, they shoot this in a parallel universe on an Alexa, an Arri Alexa. It's a small camera. It's digital. Gorgeous mm-hmm. looking footage. Is it the same film? Can he make it the same film? Is it?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think, you know, I know you've played around a lot with the Alexa, but I haven't really seen what stuff you get.
Well, a Red, a small Red or whatever. Digital.
I think you could still have achieved the same look, but I do think, or something very similar, but I do think there was something that they got by shooting 16 in terms of, you know, and it's just that the grain, that noisiness in the picture that kind of softens everything a little bit more. And I know you could still go and do a lot of that in post, and I actually know they did do a lot of that kind of stuff still in post on the show. But I do think there's something that they got with the 16 millimeter that just is, it looks different. It feels different. I don't know that if it had been shot on a Red or on an Alexa or something, if it would have changed my experience of the film. I think if it had still been shot the same way and lit the same way, I think I probably would have responded to it the same, in a similar fashion, because the story is so great. I don't know if that texture changes.
As we discuss this, are you aware that there were scenes shot on a Canon 7D in this?
Yeah, in the subway, right?
Yeah. So do mm-hmm. you feel that at any point you noticed that indifference?
I did notice in the first few I don't know if it was the first shots or the second shots in the subway, that they looked a little bit different. And I thought they looked – my initial thought was that they actually looked different, because I thought maybe they had either been underexposed and they'd had to push it or something, because it looked a little bit different than the rest of the footage. And there was even a previous shot early on in the subway where she's first going to the audition, I think. And I don't know if that was also shot on the 7D or the 5D, but there was one shot in the subway that I actually did think looked different, and I had no idea why. I remember noticing it when I saw it in the theater, and then afterwards reading about it and being like, oh, wow. Huh. And I don't know which one was which, but...
So, Ty, do you think that you noticed some of the stuff shot on a 7D and a 5D? Because that is like a one end of the spectrum to the other. Now, admittedly, it was like 1600 ISO, but...
Well, again, I mean, I unfortunately saw it as a screener, and I wasn't taken out of the film at all by any kind of discrepancy in the filmmaking on the technical side. But you raise an interesting point that I think is something that maybe doesn't get discussed often outside of the production offices of a movie, is that when a director makes a decision, he normally gives out a certain kind of set of marching orders. There's a certain kind of ambient intelligence that kind of floats in over production based on early decisions, and then the return to that initial decision or reference to that original decision. So, for example, if Aronofsky was sitting down with his team in the beginning and saying, you know, I really want to capture the vibe of these films that were shot in 16 millimeter. I really want to capture these important films that speak to me. And I'm just making this up. So I don't know. He says sure. Dirty Harry, and he says Streets of San Francisco, or he says some
French connection.
X, Y, and Z, exactly. Well, then those are usually referenced. First of all, people have a kind of aggregate memory of those things, and they kind of have an aggregate understanding, and they do kind of provide a structure for a kind of common vocabulary, a common visual language. Then they probably went out and watched those films again. And even if you don't consciously say to yourself, oh, I'm going to, use that shot, or I'm going to use that lens, or I'm going to make sure that, I come around a corner and I kind of get that shake, you start to, by osmosis, by kind of an artistic osmosis, you start to absorb that back into the mainstream of your decision-making process. And this happens a lot as a designer, where you'll have an early meeting with a director. Jim Cameron on Avatar, was talking in the very beginning to me about the vehicles, and we were talking about the mining equipment. And some of the references he made were, like, I kind of see it as being really big mining equipment that would be something that you might see in a mine today, but on a really big scale. Well, that's a small statement, and that's ultimately what was in the film, but it stopped me as a designer from looking at lots of things like, some crazy multi-armed, robotic device out of my imagination, because those avenues had already been damped down by the fact that he had kind of made a reference. He didn't say, don't do those things. He said, here's where I'm thinking we're headed. And then by default, you sort of start to channel that decision. And I think that this film kind of, my suspicion is that there was a general sense of the look that they were going for, and it was a general understanding of what the director had keyed on. And by having those discussions and viewing those pictures and bringing back to the surface of your consciousness, by default, they kind of permeate the production. And so it's not surprising that decisions, small decisions on a daily basis, are getting made. And they look at rushes or they look at dailies and they kind of go, wow, that looks great. And it happens again. And it becomes part of the motif of the picture.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to the actual visual effects work. And there is a bunch of it in there, though. Obviously, not every shot. And I guess, well, let's acknowledge that some of these shots that I thought were visual effects shots were actually just well done in camera. Now, there's some camera shots that I was interested to see how they did them, like when she's doing, ballet terms wrong here, but it's like a pirouette. She spins, locked on the director's face. I literally just had a camera on a tripod and they're just spinning the darn thing and grabbing the handle to make it stop. But the shot that I was actually referring to was that end sequence when she's falling to her ultimate death. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, oh, it's wire rig, and they've obviously removed the wires. And I was thinking, you'd be really careful about that, because you've got the camera really close to her face, and if you had any kind of spring in the cabling, then you'd clock her in the head. I shouldn't have been thinking of that at that point, but of course I can't help myself. And I discovered that was all shot vertically, that the mattress was vertical, Natalie was vertical, and the camera, of course, therefore was not moving much at all. And in fact, I think the mattress moved in on Natalie, and the camera was therefore very safe from her. And so for those reasons, and for the reasons we've already described, we need to give the DOP of this film a lot of credit, because there was the effects we're about to talk into, the digital effects, were all really working in harmony with a lot of very, very good, strong visuals. But
it's Matthew Labatique. Is that how you say his last name? Or?
Yeah, crazy haircut guy.
Yeah, yeah, spiky hair, yeah.
But really, really amazing work, given that he also had relatively low lighting and it was 16. Just spectacular. And there's a lot of subtlety we could go on about. I'm sure you guys noted also in the notes that you said earlier that our researcher and producer team had come up with that, for example, there were reflections in almost every shot off the stage and no reflections at the end when she was the Black Swan. And there's just like tons of subtle stuff going on there with color palettes. But I just want to now focus on the visual effects. And Matt, maybe you could talk to us about that because certainly there's an article on FX Guide. But for those that don't know, this is proper full-on digital matching to live action type stuff.
Yeah, there were, from everything that I was able to garner here, there were, I believe, 220 shots in the whole movie, which, you know, isn't a huge count, but I think for a movie like this, it's actually quite high.
Yeah.
Look effects in New York was, their office in New York anyway, was the head team doing the digital work. And I'm not sure how you say his last name. I know Jason Diamond, I think, knows this guy, but Dan Schrecker, I want to say, was the visual effects supervisor at Look Effects, and he actually went to college with Aronofsky, and they've worked together on Requiem for a Dream and The Fountain, and they even said that some of the movie Pi was shot in the visual effects supervisor's mom's apartment on the Upper West Side in New York City. And I think it's kind of interesting to see that these guys were friends in college, and they, you know, it's not unusual for I think a director and a cinematographer to have a really close working relationship, or maybe a director and a specific actor. But I do think you know, it is a bit unusual for a director to have such a long working relationship with a visual effects supervisor. And so I think that that's something that's kind of interesting. And then some of the there were a lot of prosthetic effects that were done for the movie as well, practical effects. And I think those were all done by a company called Renaissance Effects. And they did some of the stuff, like the most notable one was the puppeteering of the legs, where she's standing in her, you know, the pink sort of children's decor kind of bedroom with all the stuffed animals, and she's standing in there at one point, and she's sort of dealing with all these physical problems she's having with her body, and her legs kind of snap and bend backwards,
which really freaked me out.
yeah, great work. And then that was actually done with a puppet, and then they shot her, Natalie Portman, actually back in the scene, and they composited those two elements, the puppet and then Natalie Portman on top of the puppet, into the final sort of wide shot where you see her standing on those kind of broken backwards, kind of birdish like legs.
Ty, what did you think of it from an art direction point of view? I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Matt, but just while we're in that bedroom scene and stuff, there was a lot of interesting stuff in the bedroom. There was that set had a lot of interesting effects in it, because it's also where some of the hallucinogenic or drug-induced kind of fantasy stuff happened with the – I mean, from an art direction point of view, with that sort of hat on, how did you feel that that it performed?
I really saw, as far as the decisions that were made from a production design and an art direction side, I mean, everything was very well suited for the story. I mean, there were things about the environments that telegraphed a lot of information that wasn't ever stated. Like, you know, clearly there was this idea that she was kept in a room, that she was like treated as a child. That was just reinforced by this, what Matt had just mentioned, this kind of child's bedroom, you know, the little music box. And, you know, the strange behavior of the mother was amplified by this, the weird paintings that she kept and had all hung up. And there was a sense that they hadn't really been very successful. You know, there's not a lot of dialogue about it, but you get a sense this is a pretty meager apartment that the mother has, you know, had seen some glory days, and she was now, you know, a recluse. I mean, the sets played a lot in the storytelling, but I don't think that there was anything particularly specific again, I don't think there was specifics that needed to be there for the story to be told. It was more like an ambient overarch, you know, like kind of a well-conceived of tapestry of things that all had a synergy behind them. So that's kind of my very consistent.
Yeah, there was the odd scene, like the birthday cake, which was a sort of deliberate statement in a plot sense about that relationship. But you're right. A lot of that art direction just seemed to inform you as to the relationship without it being actually... one imagines sort of explicitly part of the script.
Mike, I had a question because you brought it up earlier about your take on it. Was what was your thought on, and we were just talking about the practical prosthetics and so forth. What was your take on the kind of very graphic, uncomfortable physical mutilation and the kind of, I kind of call it violence, but what would, you know, this kind of graphic on-screen violence that that went on with the toenail? What was your take on that?
I thought it was great. I thought there was I think you said it, the appropriateness to the story. There is a real harshness to ballet that is not often picked up on. The actual, if you've ever known anyone that's been in the ballet, I certainly, growing up, was friends with a bunch of girls, some of whom were in ballet or had ballet mothers that taught ballet. And it was, it was hard, hard work, and it took its toll on the girls. And I think that got echoed really well through, that this was an unforgiving discipline that really caused real physical pain, and especially that on-point stuff. And then also coupled with that was her sort of torment and anxiety and complete neurosis that formed into self-mutilation. So I thought it was great. I also found... As sort of cliched as it sounds, that you know that expression, the hair on the back of your neck goes up? The kind of stuff that was happening with her skin, with the feathers or the beginnings of the feathers, as it were, this kind of hair for what are you going to call it?
Goose flesh. And,
I mean, that just seemed to be just this perfect metaphor for what was happening to me sitting in the audience. I was like, it was just like... It was uncomfortable, and yet it was appropriate. I've got to say, I thought pretty much all of the practical stuff held up pretty darn well. The legs popping backwards, one of the few things that I thought I wasn't sure if I needed that. Maybe I needed something like that, but it just felt we're getting on the edge of if it had gone much further with that kind of stuff, I think I'd have probably... come out of the film a bit.
Yeah, well, I think you're right, but I was going to say too. I think that shot, and then the one where her toes are sort of fused together, and the there's another one where she's when she's she thinks she's strangling the her sort of what you call it, her alternate nemesis. Or whatever her nemesis, and the neck sort of stretches out in that scene and stuff. And there's all these kind of things that go like. Almost just a little too far, right, at moments. But I actually kind of thought that was great. It really reminds me a lot of some of those, you know, all the David Cronenberg movies from the 80s and stuff. You know, it really had a lot of that kind of flavor. And I think if it had gone much further, it might have been too much. But I actually feel like that – I was amazed to find that, like, pretty much everybody that, you know – co-host this show, you know, basically everybody was talking about it when we were sort of firing emails back and forth, and everybody loved it. And I do think that, you know, one of the things that I think, aside from, you know, the fact that it's a really, you know, solid film, I do think that those are things, at least for me, that it added something to it that actually made it almost more pleasurable for me, you know, like that it went beyond what was normal.
I really want to throw a spotlight on the lighting. TD or whoever was behind the integration and look of the feathers and stuff and that end performance, because I've got to say, we were talking about going too far, it would have been embarrassingly comical had the effects not sat in the film as well as they did. It was not comical because they sat in well, but you know, when you literally have her doing that end sequence, what you ended up with was majestic and frightening, not comical and cheesy. And I think that the lighting really helped there a lot, and it's lighting into 16, so that's got all of the problems with film grain and stuff. And I know that theoretically, you know, that film grain almost can help it sit in there once you apply the grain over the top. But nevertheless, it was pretty much backlit when she's moving out onto the stage, and that swan transition never felt cheesy to me. But I really think it was because of the believability of the lighting. You had to have that looking just so grounded, or it would have been just absurd. What do you think, Ty?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, you know, it's this, just this whole conversation this evening has kind of been a slow spiral towards a couple of unavoidable realities to this film. And, you know, I think that the onstage transformation of the Black Swan is its brilliance is almost transcendental. I mean, there's a moment that caught me so off guard in that sequence that I was in shock. I mean, it reminded me of seeing films when I was a much younger person, where I was just like, I wanted to go, you got to be kidding. At the same time, I wanted to kind of applaud. I mean, everything about it.
And did you just go, who's in the cupboard? I mean, I was like, who's in the cupboard? Like, who did she actually, but did she actually kill her mother? Did she kill
her? You know what? It's so funny, because in that moment on stage, by the time she gets to that last pirouette and flips her wings back, there was not another thought in my head. I was so with the movie. I was so with the moment that it was like, it will never dull in my memory. It was like that potent. And, you know, it's funny because...
I think that's the moment where people say, you know, when they showed in Venice, I think it was, they were saying that people were saying that this... A lot of people were saying it's a masterpiece, you know, and I think that's the moment where people feel that way about it.
I couldn't have believed it possible, because I was starting to see some of the transitions kind of percolating up, and I was kind of a little bit leery of, you know, I was enjoying the film so much. I was thinking, like, you know, I didn't want to be disappointed. And therefore, when I wasn't disappointed, and actually when I kind of had my ass kicked by it, I was doubly pleased. It was so memorable. And, you know, it's funny, because we've talked about so many layers to it. There's a moment where Natalie Portman, just as the Black Queen, which, again, just simple makeup, you know, just the graphic nature of her face with some, you know, with some grease paint, basically. It was so transformative. Like, whoever figured out the lines to add around her eyes and the use of the lenses, and those things just really changed her features. I mean, the lipstick, the whole nine yards. And when she comes towards camera, it's all in camera. She just makes her eyes, you know, swell up a little bit. She just brings her lids up.
There's an extra spark. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like you're kind of looking into the beast, right? I mean, you really get the sense that there's this, that she's no longer the person you've watched. And then when she does this pirouette and these wings unfold, you're completely like, you want to do a high five or something. It's a strange collection of emotions.
But it had to work. It had to work at a technical level for that to be able to be carried emotionally. You had to have...
Technically, it's genius. I mean, again, I think everything you said about the lighting is spot on. I mean, I agree with it completely. Like, but I think it's it's like, this movie is a movie of synergies to me. It's like all the pacing that led up to that scene, and the other dancers, and the dynamic of the camera moves, and the way that we were already accustomed to being on stage, we're already accustomed to kind of that cinema verite quality that we were talking about. I mean, you know, he said, you know, Aronofsky has mentioned that he wanted to bring the camera on stage because that's not traditionally where they, you know, they bring the camera in opera, I mean, in ballet type films. But what's interesting is he doesn't overplay it. I mean, you don't get a sense that you're a choreographed dancer. It's all like found footage, very, very cinema verite. And so when this spectacular digital work shows up, you're not thinking digital. You're not thinking about the execution. You're just like, you know, you're just caught in seeing this transformation and accepting it for what it is and having it pop with the storyline. And then it's an amalgamation of just spectacular work.
Well, and it's, you know, and I think it's a great example too of the kind of really big effects work, the final transformation. It feels like a huge effect, but it's a huge effect that is in such service of the director's vision and of the overall story arc that it winds up being, you know, it's digital, you know, it's not real, but it's sort of like you're like you're saying, like, you know, your head kind of explodes. You're like, is this really where we're going? And then you're like, yes, this is it. This is where we're going. We are crossing this line. And when you see it it's so well integrated and it works so tightly together. And maybe that in part comes out of the fact that these guys have had such a long working relationship too, that there's that trust there, that they wind up, you know, taking it this far. And it's so successful. I think, you know, if you were one of the TDs or one of the compositors or something that worked on that final sequence of shots, I mean, I think, God, I would kill to put that stuff on my reel. It's just so beautiful.
I was going to say, I was just underlining that point. Not only had the VFX supervisor and the director worked so long together, but this was a script 10 years in the making. So this was a well-structured, well-written. Because, I mean, we often say we want a good story first, and this was a tight script. That's why I sort of kind of was slightly dismissive of that wrestler thing, because I felt like this script was complete. It got us, it carried us to that point that we were willing to believe that wings popping out on an actress on stage wasn't silly.
There's a bookend quality to, you know, the wrestler on one end and the Black Swan on the other as a kind of body of work for the director. But, you know, it's such an original piece. I think both of them are that, you know, they both have their own, pizzazz and sparkle and relevance, you know.
So just on a personal note, when the heck did Winona Ryder become the old woman? I mean, I'm sorry.
You know, I thought you were going to go straight to that scene where she, does the visitation to her face with the nail file. But, you know, jump past that. But I was, if I could, go back to this kind of graphic on-screen violence for one last thought, because I thought you were heading there, Mike, and then it kind of shifted away, is what do you think as an audience member that kind of shocking graphic violence, disturbing imagery of the physicality does to the viewing process?
So for a start, I thought that it was well executed. It didn't look rubber skinnish. On a audience level, I think we needed something to be truly disturbing, to be truly frightening, in the same way that we needed the lesbian fantasy sequence to have her have this dark side, because you can't go to the end unless we've got some strong signposts along the way that it's in her. You know, I mean, if there's a meek little girl that suddenly at the end goes completely off the rails and goes mental, it's not as strong as if you've had glimpses into a dark, horrific kind of underside along the way. So I think we needed a dark sexuality, and we needed a dark, violent side for the end stabbing stuff to kind of not be coming out of. Where the hell did that come out of?
Yeah. No, I think it's very interesting to me, because it is kind of, you were mentioning earlier, I think you said that, you know, you can watch Jaws or Aliens and these things don't affect you as much. And I think that this particular kind of graphic imagery, actually, once you establish it in the viewer's mind as a shocking potentiality of the process of watching the film, I think it changes the neurological vantage point that you watch the remainder of the film with. I think those things they're underappreciated tools of cinema, or if they're not underappreciated, they're of late they're not utilized in the same manner. And again,
so
I
you're
would go
saying
back.
That you've set up a language where extreme violence is possible, and thus the audience now is open to that language coming back into the film, and therefore that makes it more tense.
Yeah, it sets up a certain kind of dread that I don't think sticks with you like a horror movie. I mean, I don't think that you're not sitting there with the sense like, oh my God, I don't want to know what the next thing is going to be because I'm filled with fear. It'll shock me again. I think it actually comes to the surface and kind of goes away. But I think that when it's handled as deftly as this, I think that it opens up certain regions of the viewer's receptacles. I mean, I think it changes the way you sit in the theater and view it, because you know the potential's there. I remember in Pan's Labyrinth, there's a scene in the beginning where, in the first portion of the movie, where they capture the military officers capture a guy who's hunting rabbits with his son.
Yep.
And in that moment, there's this horrific beating. You know, the guy beats this old man to death with a bottle. And it's so kind of shocking and visual that you never let go of it. You never go back to it, but you never let go. And I think what I was hoping to spark a little conversation about was, I wondered if we see so much gratuitous kind of action violence, and it doesn't really stick in your brain. You just kind of go, you can watch an action film where 15 guys are shot in the first minute of the movie, and it doesn't affect your viewing process. Whereas,
well, have you seen Once We Were Warriors?
I have, yes.
Yeah, so that's, I think, the same thing, right? It's the sense
exactly. You said it in the beginning.
And And
when I think, Ty, too, you and I had been talking, I think earlier in the week maybe, and you had mentioned that idea, and you were talking about Taxi Driver being an example of the same thing, where you kind of walk through this narrative, and there's that scene sort of in the middle of the film where Robert De Niro is in the liquor store, and he stops that robbery and shoots that kid, and it's like super violent, kind of comes out of nowhere. But in a strange way too, it really preps you and sets you up for the sort of falling action in the narrative, or the sort of final climactic sequence where he shows up to rescue the Jodie Foster character, you know, and the sort of extreme violence that you have there. And I think that's what makes something like that kind of violence portrayed in that fashion, it's much more visceral, and I think it's more shocking when it's when it comes out of nowhere like that, you know.
Yeah, I think you used the right word. It's visceral, and when you're confronted with it, I think it just slightly adjusts some internal lens. And it keeps you focused, or in my mind, it opens up like another level of receptors as an audience, so that you're kind of taking in information with a bit more focus, or something shifts, and you're actually anticipating the viewing experience or the movie itself in a slightly different manner. Anyway, that's it's all prosthetics. It's all part of the larger construction of the film. But I think it was very interestingly handled in this particular picture.
And I think it is well handled, one of the strongest tools that you have. Because I'll give you another completely left-of-field example of that, which is Psycho. Because in that, Hitchcock knew that the audience would not expect a principal lead character, who was obviously a sort of name on the marquee, to get killed early in the film. And so he knew that he could play with that perception. And I think it's a bit of the same kind of understanding of filmmaking, that if you sort of understand how the audience relates to the film, and you can open certain doors or you can cut across certain expectations, you can have a really impactful effect, something that is truly shocking because the filmmaker understood where you were in relationship to the film. Maybe it's a different point, but I do think it's from the same kind of toolbox of intelligent filmmaking.
Yeah. I think that you're speaking of the same kind of process. The last point I make on that was it came up to my mind also because The Wrestler contained similar kinds of constructions. You know, the violence of the wrestling experience with, you know, stapling and you know, using barbed wire and breaking glass, and then even at the kind of peak of that film where the Mickey Rourke character, you know, cuts his hand on a, of all things, like the most feared of any you know, kitchen appliance, you know, the meat shaving machine. But I think it's interesting that Darren has not been shy about, you know, using those tools and using them in a way that's very front and center, and then impacting the larger
thematically, he's thematically, that's kind of his thing, right? If you look at Requiem for a Dream, The Wrestler, and this film, I mean, it's all about a certain kind of Empire, right? It's all about a certain kind of physicality, right? Like it's the physical, it's the body, and it's what somebody is willing to do and put their body through, you know? I mean, that's a big part of, I think, his area of interest as a filmmaker. It seems like that's really a physical narrative that sort of takes place within a body in a way, right?
Yeah.
And I've got to say, there were also some light, funny like moments in this film. There were bits where, you know, there was some relief from the kind of pain. We shouldn't paint this as being the blackest of blackest endeavors. Obviously, we hope you've seen the film by the time you're listening to this, but I think if you're listening to this and you hadn't seen the film, you'd think we were talking about one of the most depressing films of all time.
Actually, it's such a fine film that it actually like reinvigorated my my interest in movies, you know? So
yeah.
I think that there is a certain beauty to its darkness. I mean, that sounds like some heavy metal song from the 80s, but there is kind of a celebration of cinema in that movie in a way that I thought
one of the funniest scenes in the movie though had to be where you see that character I can't remember the name of the character in the ballet, but the big black mask on the nose,
and he walks
the
male through. Character.
He walks through, and you've seen him before in the movie, and he's really scary, and he walks through at one point, and he just goes, hey. But I did want to mention, I know we're about to wrap up here, but I just did want to mention one other effect in the film that really, aside from the final transformation and all the stuff with the mirrors, but there was one other effect in the film that I thought was just really amazing, and it was an amazing feat of tracking, which was the animation of Lily's tattoo on her back, where it sort of transforms from a lily into a set of wings during the sex scene. And all I could think was watching that was how difficult it must have been to track an actress's back while she's moving like that with all the markers moving around, with shoulder blades kind of sliding and twisting around under the skin. But I thought it was a really successful and really subtle, but unusual kind of effect. In the same way that you got that with the moving of the drawings, all the drawings and paintings that her crazy mother had done of her daughter.
Yeah, I was a little less in love with the moving paintings, I must admit. Not that I hate
it was a little hokier, but part of it was I think that those paintings were also bad, you know.
Yeah, but I didn't really feel like it was something I'd never seen before.
And a little bit of a Pee Wee's Playhouse kind of a vibe.
Okay.
Gonky.
I will say this though, that if you want some more information on the visual effects and some of these shots are better seen as before and afters, then check out Ian's story over at FX Guide, The Black Swan Takes Wings. It actually was published in December 6th, so if you're at this new site, it won't be one of the high-profile, top-of-the-page ones. You'll just have to do a search on Black Swan Takes Wings, because Ian's done a great job in writing up a lot of these shots that we've been talking about, and there's some great before and afters there that he got from the guys at Look Effects. And congratulations to Look Effects, because, I mean, it's great work, and it really wouldn't have been the film it was had they not so successfully nailed some of the technical aspects that we're skirting around because we love the film so much.
Yeah, I liked Matt's. I think Matt summed it up as that, the effects were really served the story in a way that it's just so impressive when you see the craftsmanship of any department in a film so much get behind the large, vision of the director and his mission to make a movie. And the effects in this were just so, as spectacular as they were, I never felt that they did anything but support my enjoyment of the actual, or in this case, my pondering of the story of this woman.
So now I'm going to finish up and thank Todd for our research and Matt, our two producers who put the show together, and ask Ty, if people are interested in finding more about your work other than just doing an IMDb Pro search on you, is there anywhere that they can either follow you on Twitter, or do you have a website? Or
yeah, I have a website that just mostly I use for professional purposes. It has examples of my work over the years and my credits. It's Alien, as in Alien the Monster or Alien from Outer Space, alieninsect.com. So insect, I dig insects, so alieninsect.com. And I'm on, Facebook, so if anybody wants to, there's a lot of interesting stuff that gets posted up there. I'm not a Twitter guy yet. I guess maybe I should look into that.
Well, I don't think you need to be, but it's obviously interesting.
I don't want to get behind, man. I don't want to get behind.
What I like about your website is that there's a lot of actual, artwork, obviously.
Old school artwork, too.
So there's some really good kind of design stuff. And I mean, I'm talking now like firearms and elements Hellboy's gun is what I'm thinking of. But, you know, there's sort of like really quite detailed stuff, which we could talk to you about for hours, but unfortunately we've run out of time. What about you, Matt?
The same places as always. I can always be found at Virginia Commonwealth University, and you can also find me on the Twitters. I'm at Matt Wallen or at mattwallen.com.
And, of course, I'm over at fxguide.com, where we have the new website, including the new Insider option. And we'll be increasingly posting more stuff just available for people that have decided to join us and donate and become Insider members. I also want to thank you so much for listening and being a part of this show. And I guess just finishing up, I turn to you, the audience, and ask you, how do we do? Because I felt it was perfect. I was perfect. It was perfect. Until next time, see you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2011 FX Guide, LLC.